Voilà, bonjour, bienvenue pour cette première série, pour cette première leçon d'une série de quatre qui sera consacrée au texte biblique dans la lumière d'une analyse en lien avec le traumatisme. Donc ça, c'est une approche assez nouvelle et novateur. Et j'ai le grand plaisir de vous présenter le professeur David Carr de Union Theological Seminary de New York. C'est un des tout grands biblistes, pas seulement de taille, mais aussi de réputation, qui est un des rares biblistes aussi, il faut le dire tout de suite, qui essaye de faire un peu le lien entre la recherche nord-américaine et européenne. Donc, pendant ses études, David Carr a passé du temps aussi en Europe. Il était boursier de la Humboldt-Stiftung, il a donc passé du temps en Allemagne, et a en effet aussi pris un peu des approches un peu de l'école européenne qu'il a liées à des approches plus nord-américaines. Et il a aussi essayé, et ça je trouve aussi tout à fait remarquable, de faire un lien entre une analyse tout à fait sérieuse sur le plan historique, exégétique, philologique, et en fait des questions qui ont intéressé déjà des gens de l'époque, mais qui nous intéressent tous, question du genre, question de la sexualité, question anthropologique, et bien sûr aussi des questions théologiques. Et c'est un des premiers qui voilà, a commencé à réfléchir sur la manière dont on pourrait expliquer la formation de la Bible avec cette idée que différentes époques dans la formation de la Bible sont aussi en quelque sorte marquées par des crises majeures, par des traumatismes, et d'une manière ou d'une autre, les textes bibliques ensuite donnent à leur manière des réponses, qui ne sont pas toujours identiques, mais ça, vous allez le voir dans les quatre cours que M. Carr va vous proposer. Alors, je ne vais pas vous donner toute la liste bibliographique parce qu'elle est immense. Déjà au niveau des livres, j'en ai sur notre liste, peut-être elle n'est pas complète, 7 livres, c'est quand même déjà quelque chose d'important. Je voudrais peut-être signaler un livre plus particulièrement, un livre récent, qui en fait s'intéresse au thème de notre dernier colloque sur oralité et littérarité, donc « Writing on the Tablets of the Heart », où David Carr était un des premiers qui avait dit en fait cette opposition entre oralité et texte écrit est un peu à nuancer et les deux choses peuvent tout à fait cohabiter. Je vous ai amené à d'autres livres. Alors un livre qui est le plus récent, je crois, c'est Holy Resilience, Bible's Traumatic Origins. C'est autour de cela en fait que vont tourner les quatre conférences. Après, je passe au premier. Ça, c'était le premier. Oui. Voilà. Ça, c'était la thèse de doctorat qui, en fait, était consacrée à l'interprétation du texte qui parle du songe de Salomon avant qu'il construise le temple, à la fois dans le texte biblique et à Qumran et dans l'exégèse juive. David Carr aussi a fait deux introductions assez intéressantes à l'Ancien Testament, à la Bible hébraïque, The Formation of the Hebrew Bible, ça c'est assez épais, ou c'est un peu plus diachronique, et puis un autre, Introduction to the Old Testament, où c'est peut-être un peu plus traditionnel, où reprend les différents livres et les présente d'une manière très accessible. Voilà, donc je le fais passer, après, comme je vous dis chaque fois, donc je voudrais retrouver les quatre livres, parce que sans ça, je me fais grand débat à la bibliothécaire. Et la manière dont cette première leçon va se passer est la suivante. Donc, David Carr va commencer un peu en français, oui. Puis il partira après en anglais, puis je ferai de temps à autre des résumés. Et puis tous les diapositives sont en français. Donc a priori, même si vous êtes un peu mal à l'aise avec l'anglais, ça devrait quand même bien se passer. Si vous, après vous avez des questions, vous pouvez toujours les poser. Maintenant, je vais arrêter parce que autrement on n'a plus le temps de l'écouter. Donc, thank you very much for coming here for 4 lessons and the floor is yours. And on va commencer avec Osée, traumatisme et monothéisme. Voilà.
Merci, merci. Madame et messieurs, je commence par un remerciement à professeur Römer pour son amiable introduction et invitation. Je suis heureux d'avoir cette chance de vous parler aujourd'hui au Collège de France. Comme le français n'est pas l'une de mes meilleures langues, cette conférence sera dans ma langue maternelle, l'anglais. Mais je vais commencer par une brève 5 minutes introduction en français et j'espère que ce résumé en français et ma introduction ne seront trop distrayants malgré mon français très imparfait. Alors, pour commencer, voici un bref résumé en français. Ma thèse de base, est-ce que la Bible a été profondément fasciné par un traumatisme? En effet, l'essence de religion fondée sur l'écriture, par exemple le judaïsme, le christianisme, l'islam, est la réponse et la survie à un traumatisme. Nous avons dans les écritures les traumatismes et leur survie, quitte des dents, pour ainsi dire. Je soutiendrai que les écritures juives et chrétiennes ont une littérature de survie. L'accent dans cette conférence et les deux qui suivront est mis sur la Bible hébraïque, en grande partie parce que c'est mon domaine d'expertise principal. Néanmoins, dans la quatrième leçon de cette série, je vais entendre l'horizon pour parler de l'émergence du judaïsme et christianisme à partir du traumatisme de la destruction et de l'occupation romaine. Alors que j'ai votre meilleure attention, permettez-moi d'anticiper les quatre parties principales de ma présentation sur le début du monothéisme avec les réponses du prophète Osée au traumatisme de l'ancien Israël. Dans la première partie de ma conférence, je commencerai par une brève discussion sur les études contemporaines de traumatisme. En particulier, je présenterai ma propre définition du traumatisme et plusieurs autres définitions. De plus, je parlerai de la question de l'utilisation des études sur le traumatisme moderne, un accident, pour comprendre des textes anciens et non occidentaux comme la Bible. Ensuite, dans la deuxième partie de cette conférence, je passerai à l'ancien Israël, en commençant par une vue d'ensemble de ce à quoi ressemblait la religion israélite ancienne à l'époque d'Osée, et me appuyant sur les recherches bien établies par d'autres, je vais résumer comment les anciens Israélites ont adoré plusieurs divinités et ont utilisé des images pour les faire. Cela conduira à la troisième section, ma discussion de la prophétie d'Osée, elle-même et son appel novateur à adorer le Dieu d'Israël, Yahweh seul, et n'est pas utilisé d'images. Pour comprendre ce qui a incité l'appel novateur d'Osée, je discuterai de certaines caractéristiques centrales de l'oppression néo-assyrienne, un ancien empire majeur basé dans les régions de l'actuel nord de l'Irak. Et cela préparera ma quatrième et dernière section où je dirai que le nouvel appel de Osée à Israël à adorer Yahweh seul était A, une réponse au traumatisme de l'oppression assyrienne et pourtant en même temps B, un appel au monothéisme qui était inspiré de l'oppression néo-assyrienne. Je vais maintenant continuer en anglais. So before I turn to the story at hand, let me say more in this first part of my lecture about my concept of trauma and why I find this concept useful for my discussion. After all, the word trauma has been increasingly trivialized in recent years, and many studies of trauma have focused on contemporary modern experiences that are very distant from those of ancient Israel and the church. Now, I don't know about French usage, but in English, the word trauma, traumatisme, is increasingly used as a synonym just for bad suffering of some kind. I've heard the word trauma applied to experiences as diverse as genocide, on the one hand, and getting a bad grade, on the other.
David?
Yes.
Did you put the slide?
Yes. Furthermore, yeah, the trauma concept has been increasingly politicized. Trauma has come to stand for legitimate suffering. When an individual or group has been traumatized, it is difficult to offer any challenge to their claim. Moreover, some groups, such as refugee populations, are required to document their trauma in order to receive services from international organizations. So in sum, trauma is a widely used and abused concept. When I was writing my book, Holy Resilience, some people even suggested that I leave the concept of trauma on the side, focusing only on the story of how historical catastrophes had contributed to the formation of the Bible. Now, I share some of the reservations about the use of the word trauma, but I still find contemporary research on trauma helpful for study of the Bible. And here is the main reason why. Trauma, the concept of trauma, highlights how suffering can affect memory and behavior in indirect ways. There's much suffering, of course, in the world, and it has many effects on people who survive it. But the concept of trauma highlights how some suffering for individuals and groups leads to a breakdown that produces lasting but indirect effects. And my definition of trauma is implicit in this statement. As I understand it, trauma is an overwhelming, haunting experience of disaster, so explosive in its impact that it cannot be directly encountered, and it influences an individual or a group's behavior and memory in indirect ways. And that's the translation translated above you. This definition builds on characterizations of trauma by others. For example, a prominent study by Judith Herman defines trauma as the sort of extraordinary experience that overwhelms the psyche's ability to cope. Another leading theorist of trauma, Kathy Carruth, says, trauma is the confrontation with an event that in its unexpectedness or horror cannot be placed within the schemes of prior knowledge. Not having been fully interpreted as it occurred, the event cannot become a narrative recovery that's integrated into a completed story of the past. And she goes on to say, trauma is history that has no place. It is speechless terror. Finally, in an article on the metapsychology of trauma, Tarantelli describes trauma as an explosion of the psyche so catastrophic that there is no I left to experience it. The trauma annihilates the I of the psyche, batters down every frame of experience, and the psyche's templates can't comprehend it. They can't even begin to experience it. Now, people who survive trauma survive it wounded. They wall off the traumatic experience, or many people do, wall off the traumatic experience from the conscious self that keeps on living. And increasingly, they can experience side effects from this, such as intrusive flashbacks, where triggered by certain random connections of an event or sound to a traumatic event, they suddenly have an unfiltered memory of the traumatic event. Or in other cases, people can have experiences of compulsive avoidance, where they avoid, in a very compulsive way, putting themselves in any situation that would remind them of the traumatic event or trigger one of these intrusive flashbacks. Or ironically, sometimes also people can find themselves seeking out the traumatic event so that they start to feel like they're in control of it. Finally, one of the characteristics of traumatic experience that I'll speak about a lot today is the experience of self-blame. By self-blame, I mean the tendency of a traumatized individual or community to attempt to gain a sense of control by blaming themselves for their trauma. Therapists who've treated victims of a wide variety of traumas constantly testify to the way survivors hold themselves responsible for the suffering that they've undergone. Rape victims accuse themselves of being in the wrong place or of being too passive. Soldiers play and replay things they could have done to avoid a traumatic incident. Even children blame themselves for ways that they were abused by adults. Now, such self-blame, of course, can aggravate the suffering of many sufferers of trauma, and the process of recovery from trauma often involves getting freedom from such self-blame. But trauma research has helped us see why such self-blame is so common and how it, in an indirect way, is reassuring sometimes to trauma victims to blame themselves. Seems ironic, but it's often true. Kai Erickson, who's a specialist in the effects of trauma on communities, has observed that traumatized people often find comfort in the idea that they helped cause their trauma, because if they played some role in causing that trauma, they then could play some role in preventing it in the future. Is this a good time where you could summarize?
Je vais peut-être juste résumer, mais vous avez vu l'essentiel sur les diapos. Donc, dans cette première partie, le professeur Carr a juste donné sa définition du mot traumatisme en disant que c'est évidemment un mot qui est utilisé aujourd'hui dans toutes les sauces, mais qui est néanmoins utile pour comprendre ce qui se passe dans des crises nationales, en montrant en fait plusieurs réactions qui peuvent se produire face à des expériences traumatiques. Et notamment, à la fin, cette idée, en fait, d'une sorte d'autoculpabilisation, c'est-à-dire qu'on se donne, en fait, d'une certaine manière, la responsabilité des catastrophes qui arrivent. Il a donné quelques arguments ou exemples pour des cas présents, des victimes de viols qui trouvent qu'ils étaient eux-mêmes coupables, des enfants qui sont abusés, trouvent leur propre culpabilité dans ce qui est arrivé. Et ce qui est intéressant, c'est à la fin cette idée qu'enfin, si on se donne un rôle actif dans la catastrophe qui mène à cette expérience traumatique, c'est aussi parfois un moyen pour se dire que si on a provoqué la catastrophe, peut-être aussi on peut provoquer des solutions et des sorties de ces catastrophes.
Ok, merci beaucoup. Okay, so let me just do a little bit more of this first part, because if I was in your position right now, I would be asking myself, listening to me, well, these are studies of contemporary trauma, of many individuals often who have suffered trauma, and how useful would it really be for one to take such studies of 20th and 21st century trauma victims and apply them to the experiences of ancient Israel? That's the question I would be asking. And so just briefly, let me give you two responses that I would have to this question. The first is that there have been increasing number of studies that have shown that there are parallels between the experience of trauma of individuals and the experiences of trauma of communities. It's remarkable how many of the symptoms that are experienced by individuals have their analog in the experience of communities. Let me give you just one quick example. One common reaction to trauma is anger, is rage. An attempt to try to gain control of the traumatic situation by striking out at the, if you can't strike out at the person who immediately hurt you, striking out at someone who reminds you of the person who traumatized you. It's interesting, if there's, when communities experience trauma, one of the most prominent experiences of communities is to then strike out at another community. And there's an example of that I can say personally from this experience of the United States with September 11th, which was a traumatic event for many people in the United States. And the way the United States reacted to that was to an intense reaction of striking out at other communities, not only at Afghanistan, but then also at Iraq and many other countries. It was an intense and in some ways very irrational reaction of a traumatized community. These are parallels, and there are many others, between communities and individuals experiencing trauma. And the second point I would make is that although there are, of course, many differences both across culture and across time in how people heal from trauma, how people get better after they've been traumatized, the actual experience of traumatic breakdown is not new. There have always been experiences which have caused both individuals and communities to experience some kind of breakdown. They would be different for different communities, but their trauma has been something with humanity from the very beginning. Let me give you one quick example of how there's a cultural difference between ancient and modern communities. In the ancient world, it was not unusual for parents to lose a child. Many children were lost in infancy and early life. That was something people were prepared for in many ways. Of course they suffered when they lost a child. There's no question of that. But they were not traumatized to the same extent as many contemporary families would be by the loss of a child. Because in our contemporary world, people, many parents, especially in the richer, more developed parts of the world, are simply just not prepared for that kind of experience. And so in addition to all the natural suffering and loss that parents feel, there are many parents who are actually traumatized and experience the kind of breakdown I was talking about earlier from the loss of a child. And so one has to be careful when one is working across time and culture to recognize these important differences, even as it's true that trauma is something that's been around for a very long time.
Alors, d'abord, M. Carr a montré qu'il peut y avoir quand même des parallèles entre des expériences traumatiques individuelles et collectives, notamment en lien avec la colère et avec souvent la tentation de trouver des responsables pour la catastrophe. Il a donné l'exemple de du 11 septembre aux États-Unis où, suite à cette catastrophe, on a en effet stigmatisé d'autres pays comme l'Irak notamment ou des communautés comme des communautés musulmanes. Ensuite, donc, il a montré que, évidemment, si on applique les théories du traumatisme, il faut quand même aussi faire la distinction entre ce qui peut être traumatique aujourd'hui et à l'époque. Et comme exemple, il a donné, par exemple, le fait qu'on perd ou lors de la naissance, l'enfant est mort-né, ce qui est en effet quelque chose, bien sûr, aussi tragique, mais dans l'Antiquité, très, très normal d'une certaine manière, parce que la mortalité infantile étant très, très grande, alors qu'aujourd'hui, surtout dans le premier monde, ça, c'est une expérience totalement traumatisante, parce qu'on a normalement tous les moyens pour empêcher ces phénomènes-là.
Merci. OK. So with that prelude, let me turn now to ancient Israel. And I, some of what I have to say in this second part of my lecture may be something many of you already know, but it's important to recognize that before the prophet Hosea, most scholars would agree, ancient Israel was not monotheistic. Many people, of course, have the prejudice or the idea that already Moses had founded monotheism or Abraham had founded monotheism. But for reasons I'll briefly summarize here, most scholars agree that at the earliest, and there's some dispute about this, but at the earliest, there were the beginnings of monotheism with the prophet Hosea. And so even though Hosea, like many people who reform things, presents his message as if it's a return to an earlier golden age of monotheism and purity, I am saying that most scholars agree that ancient Israelite religion from the earliest possible point was in a way polytheistic and focused on material images in a way that we would find difficult to conceive now. So let me just briefly talk about some of the evidence for this. First of all, there's plenty of evidence both in the Bible and in archaeology that ancient Israelites worshipped other male deities besides Yahweh, who was the national god of Israel. Deities such as Baal, the storm god of the Levantine area, or El, who was a father, sort of creator god in the Levant, the head of the pantheon in most of the reconstructed versions of developed religion. And we see reflections of the worship of both of these deities, or the honoring of both of these deities in ancient Israel. This is an image of the Samaritan Ostraca number 2 that features two names, Abi Baal and Mary Baal, at the bottom. Both of these names, you can hear their name Baal in them. Abi Baal, my father is Baal, and Mary Baal, my lord is Baal. Or also, we see evidence for the adoration of El in various place names, such as Yisrael, which is the name of the people Israel, which we're not sure exactly what it means, but it's something like El fights or El rules. Or the town name Bethel in the Bible is the house of El or temple of El. Moreover, many ancient Israelite sanctuaries, and there were multiple Israelite sanctuaries at the time of Hosea, featured a stone pillar, much like the one that's depicted here, which helped to represent the male deity to the worshipers at that sanctuary. Or we also have archaeological evidence in the ancient Levant for worship using calf or bull figures as the one picked here, or various Ammonite and other northern Israelite seals, such as those that are pictured here. And I don't know if you can see them very well, but you can see there are various steer figures in these seals. Or finally, this last image of a bull figure from Darat el-Tawil in the Samaritan hill country. But Israel's worship was not just confined to male deities. This needs to be emphasized. One of the most interesting archaeological discoveries of the last decades has been a series of inscriptions that speak of Yahweh and his Asherah. For example, you see this, this inscription from Kuntalit Adrud, Pithos A, I bless you by Yahweh and his Asherah. Or a tomb inscription from Kirbet El-Kom, blessed be your Yahu, by Yahweh and his Asherah. Now the translation of this phrase, Yahweh and his Asherah, was initially disputed, but most now agree that this phrase associates Yahweh with the mother goddess of the Canaanite pantheon, who was named Asherah. Or at least it associates him with Asherah's symbol, which was the tree. Now, Asherah, the goddess Asherah, was originally the consort of El, the head god of the Canaanite pantheon. These ancient Israelite inscriptions, however, speak of Asherah as Yahweh's consort. And many Israelite cult centers and the Jerusalem temple itself seem to have had stylized trees which represented the goddess Asherah in those sanctuaries, alongside the pillars representing the male god. A number of Iron Age sites also have the sort of female pillar figurines that are shown here, which represented some kind of feminine deity, whether Asherah or another Canaanite goddess. Figurines, of course, are now called idols in the Old Testament, and they're judged negatively. But that is largely because Hosea's message of rejection of such images and other gods ended up carrying the day. That's a later perspective. Now, finally, my focus on ancient worship using images leads to one final feature of ancient religions, including those of Israel. When people in this ancient world experienced suffering or even trauma, and they did experience some trauma, they, like many people across the ages, engaged in self-blame. That also was not new. But they usually attributed their suffering to having failed to worship their own God enough. They did not attribute their suffering to having worshiped other gods. For example, in this Mesha inscription, which is in the Louvre, Mesha, the king of Moab in the 9th century, looks back on a time when his people was oppressed by Israel. And he attributes that experience, that painful experience of oppression by Israel, to the fact that the national deity Chemosh was angry with his land. This sort of self-blame for communal suffering was commonplace, and there were various rituals by which people could regain their God's favor by means of gifts and prayers. So in conclusion to the second part, the religion of ancient Israel before Hosea, and even during his time, was not monotheistic. Ancient Israelites would not have viewed worshipers of Baal or Asherah as wicked or unfaithful, and gods such as Baal, El, Asherah, and Yahweh had been worshipped in Israel for centuries. Statues like the Bethel calf or the Asherah tree were ancient ways to represent such gods to everyday Israelite worshipers. This wasn't idolatry for Hosea's contemporaries, and they had no idea of polytheism being a problem. This was normal. Yet this religious normal of Hosea's time and many other aspects of normality in Israel were about to be shattered by an imperial onslaught by Assyria that Israel would not survive. But before I talk about that in my next part, I'll let Thomas go.
Brièvement, donc, vous avez vu les images pour en fait souligner l'hypothèse de départ selon laquelle on ne peut pas parler de monothéisme. Donc, après, il faudra voir ce que c'est monothéisme avant l'époque du prophète Osée, donc 8e siècle. Auparavant, on a des attestations de toutes sortes selon lesquelles les Israélites ont vénéré des divinités comme El, qui est le chef des panthéons cananéens, ou Baal, le dieu de l'orage. Il vous a montré un ostracon où on peut voir en fait des noms Meribaal et c'était quoi l'autre?
Abibaal.
Et puis des sceaux et d'autres représentations où vous voyez des, des taureaux qui en effet peuvent se mettre en relation avec la fameuse histoire du veau d'or. Mais il n'y a pas seulement que des divinités mâles, il y a aussi des attestations sur un couple Yahvé-Asherah, bien que peut-être André Lemaire va nous donner son point de vue tout à l'heure, on verra. Mais David Carr pense donc aussi que nous avons là en fait un reflet d'une vénération de la déesse Asherah qui d'abord est associée à elle et qui sera associée à Yahvé. D'autres évidences pour des déesses, ce sont ces figurines féminines que souvent sont interprétées comme des déesses. Et donc, pour les anciens, évidemment, c'est rien de négatif. Ce n'était pas l'idolâtrie telle qu'on le comprend aujourd'hui dans une perspective monothéiste. Le culte des images était faisant tout à fait partie du culte normal, régulier. Et ce qui peut être encore à souligner, David Carr a fini par vous montrer la stèle de Mécha qui se trouve au Louvre et qui montre en fait l'idée des divinités tutélaires de chaque nation qui peuvent justement se mettre en colère contre un peuple, et on explique ainsi des défaites militaires, par exemple, par le fait que tel ou tel dieu, comme sur la stèle de Mécha, Kemosh, s'était en effet retiré, s'était mis en colère contre son peuple et a permis à Omri, donc au roi d'Israël, de conquérir une partie du territoire de Moab. Donc ça, c'est en fait l'image traditionnelle qui va changer de manière assez radicale au moment en fait de la domination assyrienne qui va provoquer en 722 la chute de Jérusalem. Et c'est de cela que David Carr va parler maintenant.
Ok, merci. All right, so, as Thomas was summarizing, at the very end, sometime in the 700s BCE, the nation of Israel. And here I'm thinking particularly right now of the northern kingdom of Israel, where Hosea was located, whose capital was Samaria. This nation was attacked and fell under the domination of the greatest superpower of its time, Assyria. The Assyrian Empire, as I mentioned in my French summary, was based in Mesopotamia, in what is now northern Iraq. And it gradually, for reasons that are not completely understood, expanded its control over various areas surrounding it, including moving to the west to control the area of Syria, Palestine, and even eventually including the area of Egypt for a time. The Assyrian military machine that did this was unparalleled for its time, and the Assyrians carefully cultivated a reputation for brutal punishment of all who defied them. An appropriate dose of terror could accomplish things for the Assyrians much more cheaply than a large dose of military might. Now, from 745 onward at least, the Assyrian army, which was, as I mentioned, the most efficient and effective military machine in its time, at least for a time, repeatedly destroyed the armies of Israel and its allies. The equivalent loss of life in Europe or the United States would equal millions of soldiers and civilians. And the survivors of such attacks suffered from a famine caused by devastation of croplands that Assyrians left in their wake. Now, actually, the images I'm showing you here, by the way, come from an Assyrian palace, the palace of Sennacherib, his throne room, and they are not of the destruction of the northern Israelite context, but of the largest fortress town outside Jerusalem in Judah, Lachish. But I put them on the screen just to illustrate to you in a vivid image form the attack of the Assyrians on an actual town in the area which we're describing, including putting a siege engine up the ramp. You have the bowmen here. You have people being led off into exile and people being impaled outside the city walls as a sign of what would happen to people who resisted Assyria. And it was these images that someone would see who was coming to Sennacherib, say, to talk with him or to bring their tribute. So, people who were subject to this kind of domination by Assyria had to pay an annual tribute to the Assyrian king and swear loyalty to their Assyrian conquerors through a vassal treaty or a covenant or a treaty of succession. Now, I should mention for clearly, we're not exactly sure how many countries were subject to these treaties and how widely known they were, but they bear certain important similarities to the kind of spirituality that we see emerge under Hosea and through the book of Deuteronomy. Now, the Assyrians, I should mention also, did not invent these kinds of vassal treaties. They'd been used before, but they perfected them as a way to enforce loyalty on the nations they dominated. These vassal treaties, or covenants, called on everyone in a given country to love the Assyrian king exclusively and reject any alliance with any other country. Foreign alliances, of course, were something the Assyrians wanted to be sure that the Israelites and other subject nations didn't engage in, because it was the main way that small nations like Israel could resist the oppression of a larger superpower like Assyria. And not surprisingly, Israel and many other countries tried to form alliances anyway during times when they perceived the Assyrian kingship to be vulnerable, such as during throne transitions. But these rebellions were never successful. Instead, the attacking Assyrian armies just punished the kingdom of Israel by killing more people, reducing the size of the kingdom, and installing supposedly pro-Assyrian leaders. And then finally, in 722, just a few decades after this whole process started in a more formal way, the Assyrians wiped the northern kingdom of Israel off the map. They permanently destroyed the capital of Israel, which was in Samaria. They dismantled the monarchy and permanently removed many people from Israel, probably thousands of surviving Israelites, anyone who could conceivably lead a rebellion. There were still, of course, many other people left in Israel, but they took away many people who could foment a rebellion and moved in people from other lands to take over those former Israelites' homes and fields. And this has led to many rumors, of course, over the years of what happened to all these tribes of Israel. But we don't ever see the reconstruction of a kingdom in Israel comparable to the northern kingdom after this occurs.
Donc, l'Empire assyrien, qui se met en place à partir du 9e et surtout 8e siècle, qui, pour des raisons qui ne sont pas tout à fait claires, a cette ambition en fait de rouler sur l'ensemble du monde connu à l'époque, va en effet provoquer un grand changement sur le plan politique dans le Levant. La plupart des petits États se trouvent en état de vassalité. Les Assyriens reprennent à leur compte pratiques de traités de vassalité qu'ils perfectionnent et qu'il impose aussi avec beaucoup de violence et de cruauté. Donc apparemment, c'est en effet un empire qui se base surtout sur le militaire et sur l'armée. Il y a eu des coalitions des petits royaumes contre les Assyriens, mais qui n'ont jamais beaucoup de succès. Israël, en fait, fait aussi partie. Et ce qu'il faut peut-être souligner, c'est aussi toute cette propagande qui est faite par les Assyriens, à la fois par les textes, mais aussi par les images. Donc vous avez vu un certain nombre d'images qui montrent à la fois les déportations, mais aussi le pouvoir de l'armée assyrienne. Et cette situation mène en effet à 722, à la disparition du royaume d'Israël, qui est intégré en fait dans le système des provinces assyriennes. Et nous ne savons pas très bien exactement ce qui se passe après 722. Il est clair qu'il n'y a plus de royauté israélite qui va ressurgir de cette région. Mais les textes bibliques sont assez silencieux par rapport en effet à la situation en Israël après 722.
Okay. All right, so I'm conscious for the specialists in this room, much of what I've had to say in the last two parts is either widely known or there are parts that are disputed here and there, but none of this is original research. But when I come back in this fourth part now to Hosea is where we finally come to Hosea and his response to this experience of trauma. Now, what's unusual about what Hosea says in the midst of this situation is that he insists that the kinds of things his people are doing to try to solve this problem of Assyrian oppression were actually making it worse. When his people try to gain support through worshiping Baal, Hosea says it's like they are trying to play the whore in Hosea 5:3. Or the very altars that Israelites build to atone for their sins, Hosea suggests actually aggravate them. Hosea preaches, Ephraim keeps building altars for his sins. These very altars are themselves a sin, Hosea 8:11. And he even proclaims that Israel's golden calf at the main royal sanctuary in Bethel and other divine symbols incur God's wrath and will be destroyed. In Hosea's view, Israel's unfaithfulness to God, its worship of Baal, and devotion to divine images, however ancient they might be, are precisely the reason why the people are suffering under Assyrian oppression. As for example, in Hosea 13, he says, "And now they keep sinning and make a cast image for themselves, false gods of their own invention, made out of silver, all of it the work of mere craftspeople. Humans even kiss calves." Now, to a typical Israelite, this kind of criticism must have sounded nothing short of blasphemy, or at least ridiculous. Golden calves, or at least steers, were an ancient Israelite symbol, as I've mentioned, and Hosea's peoples had worshipped them for centuries alongside deities like Asherah or El. And although Hosea, as I said, might be imagining a time back in the wilderness when Israel didn't worship such deities, Hosea's contemporaries would not have known such a time, because it was pluralistic and involved material images. And so it was in this context that Hosea's prophecy was revolutionary. And his audience would have needed a lot of help being persuaded to give up the help of gods like Baal or Asherah, along with especially ancient symbols like the golden calf or the Asherah tree, especially at a time when they felt in need, when they were suffering under Assyria. So in the midst of this context, Hosea got their attention with a radical act and even more radical idea. At least if we go with the beginning of the book of Hosea, he married a prostitute and built his prophecy on the idea that his marriage was a symbol of God's relationship to Israel. Yahweh, according to Hosea, was married not to Asherah, but instead Yahweh was married to his people Israel. And no one before had come up with the concept that God might possess a people the way an ancient husband possessed a wife. We, of course, have some ancient myths in Mesopotamia and elsewhere where about gods marrying goddesses, and there were even rituals by which ancient kings could enter into a sacred marriage with a priestess representing a goddess. But in this case, Hosea was reimagining the relationship between Yahweh and an entire people as that between a man and wife. Now, Hosea's ancient marriage at the time of Hosea involved many things: love, procreation, the raising of children, often a partnership in providing food and goods as part of a small-scale farm. And it also involved reciprocal obligations of husband and wife, but they were not equal. The husband was to protect and provide for his wife, while the wife was expected to be sexual with her husband and only with her husband. And that was a one-way expectation. Ancient laws prescribed harsh penalties for adulterous wives and the men who had sex with them. A married woman who had sex outside her marriage faced possible death, or at least stripping, humiliation, and shaming if she was discovered by her jealous husband. In one of his most famous prophecies, Hosea depicts Yahweh as exactly this kind of jealous husband. This time, a husband of the people of Israel. At the beginning of the prophecy, God speaks to Israel's children, proclaiming, "To court, take your mother to court, for she is no longer my wife, nor am I her husband." Ancient husbands could divorce their wives by merely proclaiming such words, and this first sentence suggests that Yahweh is divorcing Israel. But then he goes on to offer his people an alternative. "She, Israel, must remove her whoring ways from her face and her adulterous offspring from between her breasts, lest I strip her naked and expose her like the day she was born and make her as bare as the desert. I'll make her as dry as barren lands and let her die of thirst." Now, with these words, Hosea informs his audience that the religious practices that they thought were sacred are as repugnant, as evil as a wife's infidelity was to them. Yahweh is about to withdraw from the people of Israel his husbandly protection. And if the people of Israel want to avoid being stripped and humiliated in front of their false lovers and left to die of thirst, Hosea says that they must renounce and stop their worship of Baal and divine images. God's ultimate hope is that Israel, his wife, will return to him. And after all the suffering, she will say, "I'll go back to my first husband, for it was better for me back then than now." So Hosea proclaims a God who uses violence, indeed the violence that some men inflicted on their wives in ancient Israel, and in this case, Assyrian domination violence, to bring his wayward wife back to him. And this is, I suggest, a way Hosea is suggesting to his book that they should process and deal with the trauma of the Assyrian attack. Hosea's people faced an impossible situation. Their lives were falling apart. And within this traumatic situation, the metaphor of marriage that Hosea developed here was a shock intended to produce a radical change in that people, where they thought the Assyrian crisis could be managed by worshiping their deity more, and even more deities the better. Hosea suggests something deeper is really wrong. Israel is suffering because it failed to be exclusively loyal to Yahweh. Israel was suffering because it had sinned. Now, this was a new form of self-blame, a different one than they'd seen before. It offered Israel a different way to feel as if they had power over a traumatic situation. As I've said, where earlier religion suggested they could worship more deities more, Hosea suggested they had to stop worshiping some deities at all. And in depicting worship of other deities as adultery, Hosea picked up on some important images from Assyrian royal propaganda. Assyrian propaganda had said that Israel was being punished when the Assyrian armies came through because they had failed to be exclusively loyal to the Assyrian king, to love the Assyrian king exclusively. But Hosea suggests that the real king that the people are failing to be loyal to is Yahweh. Yahweh, not the Assyrian king, is the one who demands absolute loyalty. And much like the Assyrian king required his vassals to love him alone, Hosea's picture of Yahweh required Israel to love this God alone. And in this way, Hosea did a remarkable thing that would shape the future course of religious history. He redescribed Israel's God, Yahweh, as a reflection of the world-dominating, loyalty-demanding Assyrian king that Israel was encountering in their life at that very time. In other words, Hosea saw God's face in the catastrophe that his people of Israel were facing.
Alors la réponse du livre de Hosée au traumatisme provoqué par les Assyriens commence d'abord par une critique des images. Il reproche en fait à ses destinataires d'embrasser des taureaux, etc. Ce que pour des destinataires de l'époque a dû paraître d'abord une accusation ridicule parce que c'était comme ça qu'on vénérait des dieux. Mais la grande invention, le grand changement qui intervient avec le livre d'Hosée, c'est en fait de dissocier d'une certaine manière Yahvé à Asherah et de donner en fait à Yahvé une autre femme qui est en fait le peuple d'Israël. Donc l'idée en fait de comprendre la relation entre Yahvé et son peuple comme la relation entre un mari et sa femme, évidemment avec tout ce qui va avec pour l'époque ancienne, un mari qui peut en effet facilement divorcer de sa femme, qui peut aussi la traiter avec beaucoup de violence. Et évidemment dans cette image-là, le fait que Israël vénère d'autres dieux que Yahvé est considéré comme justement une prostitution, un adultère, une infidélité pour lequel en fait Israël va être puni. Et c'est pour cela aussi le livre de Hosée commence avec cet acte symbolique où le prophète lui-même est appelé à épouser une prostituée pour montrer en fait la relation difficile entre Yahvé et Israël. Donc là, il y a une sorte là de autoculpabilisation qui est introduite avec l'idée, en fait, d'une infidélité du peuple par rapport à son mari qui est Yahvé, ce qui aussi est une reprise d'une certaine manière de l'idéologie assyrienne, puisque dans les traités de vassalité, l'idée est évidemment qu'il faut une loyauté absolue au grand roi assyrien et que toute déviance sera évidemment sanctionnée de manière très sévère. Alors cette image maintenant est repris sur la relation entre Yahvé et Israël, avec donc l'idée que Israël doit une loyauté absolue à Yahvé, qui est donc en effet considéré comme son mari.
Oh, merci. Okay, so I only have a very brief summary, which I'll abbreviate a little because I know the time has run a certain distance because of the mix of summary and so on. But I want to talk a little bit at the end about some of the implications of what I've been talking about. Now, Hosea's image of God as an Assyrian-like monarch punishing a disobedient people are disturbing for many readers, and rightly so. It's hard to, in particular, for me to argue for or redeem this picture of Hosea of God as an abusive husband, in particular. But I would suggest that prophecies like Hosea's, which are born in trauma, certainly had major effects over time. Indeed, effects on generations that Hosea never could have imagined hearing his prophecy. His monotheistic or proto-monotheistic message was to be extended well beyond anything he could have imagined. He had interpreted a specific historical crisis, the Assyrian onslaught, as the result of his people's attachment to Baal, Asherah, and other gods rather than Yahweh. But in time, his message was reapplied by later generations to explain very different situations, wars and other disasters and losses, individual and communal. In this way, normal human life, which of course across all time and cultures is all too frequently characterized by experiences of trauma, this normal traumatic human life became what I would describe as a God shredder, or at least among the peoples who inherited this monotheistic message. Future generations of Jews, Christians, and Muslims themselves would suffer their own experiences of trauma, not the Assyrians, but perhaps the Babylonians and later other peoples, the Romans and so on. And like others undergoing trauma, they would look for an explanation for their suffering, something that would give them a fragile sense of control. Monotheism provided that explanation. Understood within the frame of the monotheistic impulse, suffering of all kinds, and especially trauma, now could be explained by one's failure to give up old gods. Violence, disease, famine, and other calamities would come in waves across history, each standing as a potential argument for increased devotion to the one true God and abandonment of false ones. And so, with more trauma in Israel and later, Hosea's rejection of other gods and rejection of symbols of other gods led to a more thoroughgoing monotheistic belief that the world did not have any gods but one, and that God was ever harder to picture. In other words, the trauma-induced rejection of other gods by Hosea, working on the Assyrian model, produced an ever more disenchanted world. A world without gods. And from this disenchanted world, of course, it was but then a shorter step to the secularized worldview that characterizes much of Europe, urbanized North America, and other parts of the rich, developed world. Now, of course, in Hosea's case, he was calling for increased devotion to Yahweh. No question. But in calling for exclusive devotion to Yahweh and rejection of other gods, Hosea started a movement of rejection of belief in tangible deities in the world, a rejection of gods caused by trauma that still has its impact today. Thank you very much for your attention.
Voilà, je donne un tout bref résumé de la conclusion, mais je crois que vous l'avez compris. Donc l'idée, c'est en fait de montrer comment ce proto-monothéisme de Osée, qui en fait est une adaptation d'une demande à l'exclusivité assyrienne, peut mener après vers un monothéisme plus élaboré qu'on trouve par exemple dans le deuxième Ésaïe, mais aussi en ultime vers ce que David Carr a appelé le désenchantement du monde, en fait, où en effet, bien sûr pas pour Osée, mais petit à petit, en fait, le monde devient un lieu où les dieux sont plus tellement nécessaires non plus les raisons ultimes des choses qui arrivent. Voilà, donc on peut prendre encore quelques questions.